we're not getting the job done. And I'm not going to blame myself, I'll be honest. They are not getting the job done.
See that buck? It's way over there. Not here. It doesn't stop here.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Their fault.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. In Oregon on 91.7 KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 KSO in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1. In Palinville, New York on 102.9 WLPP. In Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR. In New Orleans on WHIV 102.3. In Washington, D.C. on 105.5. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe on the internets every day on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Deprogrammed Radio, Workforce Rising, Detour Talk, and Radio Sputnik. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman. Your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around fantastic fellow, says me.
And me too, sometimes.
Oh, thank you. Sometimes. From bradblog.com, thank you very much for joining us. That was Desi Doyen, our producer.
Oh, you're fantastic most of the time.
Thank you for saying so. That's what we pay you for. The madness of King Donald continued, of course. Did you expect it wouldn't? Over the weekend and into today with some crazy remarks at the White House before a cabinet meeting today, before the media and then just before air at another freewheeling last-minute press conference that was announced along with his hostage, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, by his side. But there is reason why he made McConnell come out with him and try to put a happy face on all of the dysfunction of late being reported out of this White House. There must be, right, to send the message, everything's going great, he's doing well, he's getting along just fine with Congress. Well, we will be speaking momentarily with the one and only Heather Digby Parton of Salon and Hullabaloo about that and this crazy so-called religious, I have to say a lot of so-calleds today, so-called religious right summit over the weekend where Trump also spoke. So we'll talk about that as well with Digby very shortly. But a lot of important stuff that I want to try to get to here before we get to her. The BBC reports at least three people have died so far as hurricane force gusts battered the Republic of Ireland. That as the remnants of what had been Hurricane Ophelia, a Category 3 hurricane. It was Category 3 at one point,
yes,
was it not?
Yes, it reached Category 3 status.
It blew ashore with top wind speeds clocked over 100 miles per hour in Ireland. NPR says post-tropical cyclone Ophelia slammed parts of Ireland with wind gusts of more than 90 miles per hour, reportedly causing the deaths of at least three people and bringing strange red skies to the UK. As of Monday afternoon, Ophelia had knocked out power to about 360,000 customers in Ireland, according to ESB Networks, which operates the country's power system. Irish authorities have ordered schools, courts, and government buildings to remain closed, according to the AP. Schools in Northern Ireland are closed Monday and Tuesday owing to, quote, the prolonged nature and potential severity of the storm, according to the Department of Education. This is a hurricane, or now a post-hurricane tropical cyclone, whatever they call it there, in Ireland. Ophelia's location is already historic. As the Two-Way reported, Colorado State University meteorologist Philip Klotzbach noted that when the storm reached Category 3 status on Saturday, that made it, quote, the farthest east an Atlantic major hurricane has existed on record.
That's a pretty big deal, and that's fueled by extra warm, unusually warm Atlantic Ocean temperatures. Hurricanes don't usually get up there. It's not unheard of, but it's extremely rare.
It is rare enough that Eric Corey pointed out on Twitter that at a certain position north and east of the British Isles, the map just simply cut off.
Right. So when you look at the forecast, they've never programmed a hurricane of that intensity to get that far. It's literally just dropped off the graph.
Yeah. You see the cone, the familiar, what do they call it?
The cone of uncertainty.
Cone of uncertainty. And then it stops at a couple places north and east because their software don't do that. These storms don't go this far north like this. The map simply cuts off. The storm winds brought warm air up through the UK, causing unseasonably high temperatures. And according to the Met Office, that red sky, do you know why that red sky
was
reported?
Yes, I do. The red sky is because hurricane force winds from Ophelia kicked up dust from Africa. Drew all the way up to England. They sucked it all in there.
They say, according to the Met Office, this was drawn from the Sahara.
The Sahara, yes.
So all the way down from the Sahara was carried up north to Ireland in this storm.
Yeah, and also the winds from Ophelia are fueling fires in Spain and Portugal.
So that dust, apparently, at our latitudes, the Met Office says it makes the dust scatter the blue light from the sun, letting more red light through, much as it, like a sunrise or a sunset, must now look apocalyptic. Ophelia is expected to track northeast into Northern Ireland and Scotland. So, no, nothing wrong at all. This is all totally normal. Don't be alarmed. Climate change, Chinese hoax. Meanwhile, what...
Those Chinese sure are industrious.
Aren't they, though? What most certainly appear to be apocalyptic is these scenes and these stories still coming out of Northern California, where wind gusts picked up again over the weekend but began to subside along with the temperature on Sunday, allowing fire officials to say that they think they are beginning to turn the corner in the fires that have ravaged Northern California over the past week, with more than a dozen still burning out of control today as of airtime. The death toll spiked over the weekend to at least 40 killed in the blazes. Nearly 200 are said to still be missing as of today, with some 5,700 structures, homes and commercial buildings completely incinerated.
Down to the foundations.
Tens of thousands are still evacuated and in shelters out here in California as the fires have scorched some 220,000 acres in Northern California wine country and other areas. And I can tell you, I'm glad the temps are dropping and the winds are easing. But down here in Southern California, it is dry as hell. I went out to take a walk today, Des, and by the first block, I could barely breathe or swallow.
Yes,
it's
bone dry. It's extremely dry here. Extremely low humidity, extreme high heat, and that's a recipe for tinderbox conditions that create these fires.
At a Sunday afternoon briefing, the California Fire Commander told reporters that overall things are feeling optimistic for us. We are very cautious about that, however, he added. Officials warn that the biggest threat remains that low humidity, with that dry air continuing to transform grass and vegetation into fuel. It's been drying out the mountains, said the National Weather Service forecaster Steve Anderson. It's still going to be bone dry out there overnight. More than 10,000 firefighters from California and other states and other countries, a bunch have come in all the way from Australia, are now still fighting these fires. And we haven't had a chance to talk about this much, Desiree, but one of the wettest winters on record, followed by the hottest summer on record. Actually, we need to go back. We had one of the worst droughts.
We had the worst drought on record, 6 years of record drought. And then this past winter, California as a state recorded its wettest winter on record.
And you would think when you hear that, that, oh, we had the wettest winter, so why is it so dry?
Well, right. And so what's happened, though, is that wettest winter spurred a lot of plant growth, a lot of underbrush growth, a lot of grass growth. And then when we hit right after that, the hottest summer on record, it dried out all that new fuel. And that new fuel is what's catching fire now with these, you know, these incredible extreme conditions that we have.
There's a scientific formula, apparently, that experts use to determine the potential of a fire. It's called the energy release component, according to a Cal Fire spokesperson, and said on Saturday that the potential right now, as it exists in California, is the worst, quote, in recorded history. Crews have not seen this amount of fuel this dry in the path of a fire in at least 26 years, he said. Members of the public are being urged to avoid helping in the cleanup because the Napa County Public Health Director declared a local emergency in order to bring in more resources to remove the toxic ash and burnt remains of homes and cars.
Yes, all of that plastic releases toxins, and that's why it's very toxic there right now, and that's unfortunate.
FEMA is conducting a damage assessment. That's the Federal Emergency Management Agency. They're providing aid to local agencies, reportedly offering federal funding to residents affected by the fire. One traffic official who was working on clearing some of the roads said, "We're going to be here for weeks." He said, "I'm 51 and have been in California my whole life. I've never seen a fire this bad." Officials believe the death toll will rise from, what is it now, 40, as the searchers make their way through neighborhoods in Santa Rosa, entire neighborhoods that burned down, as well as in the mountain communities across wine country. But the good news, in addition to the cooler temperatures and winds dying down a bit over the weekend, is that some rain is actually in the forecast for parts of the state later this week. So that could bring some much-needed relief. Governor Jerry Brown and U.S. Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris visited areas affected by these fires. Brown said the devastation is just unbelievable. He said, "I just drove by hundreds of houses that were literally destroyed," during a news conference on Saturday. In the meantime, the president of the United States has not, to my knowledge, even mentioned these fires publicly, has he?
No, as far as I can, not up until airtime, he had not.
That despite the extraordinary damage.
And a loss of life.
Nor has he discussed a visit out here, despite, you know, more having been killed at this point, I believe, in the in California in these fires than in the hurricane disasters in Florida and Texas. Which he visited quickly, and nearly as many killed, at least in the official death count. Some say it could be down in the hundreds down in Puerto Rico, but nearly as many as the official death count following Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. And so Trump hasn't discussed these fires, much less the reason that they are so bad, as Governor Brown acknowledged during a press conference late last week.
That's the way it is with a warming climate and dry weather and reducing moisture. These kind of catastrophes have happened, they'll continue to happen, and we have to be prepared to do everything we can to mitigate.
That was Jerry Brown, who is not afraid to talk about climate change, unlike our president, who is undoing everything that had been put in place by his predecessor to try to at least mitigate exactly what Jerry Brown was talking about there. And speaking of climate change, what causes it and things that Donald Trump does not like to talk about, authorities searched by air and water today for a contractor who disappeared when an oil and gas platform exploded on Lake Pontchartrain, north of New Orleans, on Sunday night. Seven people were injured in that blast, including three who were in critical condition today, according to authorities, and still one missing. The Coast Guard reported that a fire aboard the structure was finally out. That's the good news, out by midday on Monday after burning throughout the night. Coast Guard helicopter, along with Coast Guard vessels and boats from local agencies, continue to look for this missing worker. from this oil platform. This is the Clovelly Oil Company platform. Exploded on Sunday night, sent a fireball into the night sky. According to authorities and company officials, authorities on the scene reported that the cleaning chemicals had ignited in the structure, but that the company said that the cause of the blast is still unknown at this point. Have you heard anything more about
the cause? No, I have not heard any new causes yet. You know, since the fire is only just now out, they'll have to start their investigation at that point. It sounds remarkably similar to the Deepwater Horizon explosion where natural gas kicked up through the oil rig, but it's not clear that that's what's happened
No,
here.
It's not, because apparently a statement from Clovelly said that the three oil wells near the platform were shut down at the time of the explosion. And it had one gas well, I guess natural gas well, was flowing, but that was successfully shut in shortly after the explosion. So we don't know what mess, if any, so far it's leaving in Lake Pontchartrain. But that fire now seems to be out, and hopefully there's not an oil leak that is unknown. The company does not know if there was any oil released yet. Basically, this platform is a storage point for oil and gas from a number of these different wells around it. And the oil and the gas goes into these this tank at this platform. And when it's filled up, the oil or the gas is pumped onto a barge and then moved.
Right. So it's a central hub for all of these local wells. And just because something is shut in, it unfortunately doesn't mean that it's not leaking still.
Ah, true. These wells were drilled back in the 1970s. This is a brackish tidal basin, Lake Pontchartrain is. It's fed by both the Gulf of Mexico, salt water from there, and fresh water from a bunch of rivers and streams. Including the Mississippi River. The good news there, as far as I can tell, is that even if oil leaked, I don't believe anybody gets their drinking water out of Lake Pontchartrain because it is brackish. The bad news, however, in addition to the injuries and potential fatalities still here, the U.S. Geological Survey describes Lake Pontchartrain as one of America's largest estuaries and waters supporting oysters, crabs, and saltwater fish. So that may be imperiled for a while. We'll find out. So the Coast Guard will be doing water quality evaluations in the coming days. So there's that. And speaking of other things that we don't talk about, Iraqi state television. This is kind of amazing. Well, all right. Iraqi state television, according to New York Times, said early on Monday that Iraqi forces had begun an operation to seize the Kurdish-held city of Kirkuk and its surrounding oil fields. Despite weeks of urgent efforts by the U.S. to keep tensions between its own allies, both of these folks are the Kurds and the Iraqis are its allies. Efforts to keep it from boiling over into another war in the Middle East. State-run TV said the initial assault by Iraqi troops, counterterrorism forces, and federal police did not encounter resistance to reclaim areas that were seized by the Kurdish forces in 2014. Military sources also reported that there were exchanges of artillery fire, unconfirmed reports of clashes with the Kurdish Peshmerga, that's the Kurdish fighting forces, who have been maintaining defensive lines around these oil fields. Well, the Iraqi military operation would be the first use of military force by the government in Baghdad in response to an independence vote last month by the autonomous Kurdish region in northern Iraq. If you're trying to follow all of this along at home, basically here's what we have. U.S. armed and trained Iraqis are now fighting U.S. armed and trained Kurds, both of whom are supposedly fighting against ISIS, along with a big chunk of Iraq's fighting force that has been trained and armed by Iran, which Donald Trump essentially threatened to go to war with last week. That's the current state of U.S. foreign policy in the region. Completely dysfunctional, apparently impotent to keep the two of the strongest supposed U.S. allies in the region, Iraq and the independent Kurds in the north, from attacking each other. But the real winner here if there is any winner, is the U.S. arms industry. It's almost certainly rejoicing today as Donald Trump becomes seemingly more powerless in this foreign policy, thanks to his just utterly chaotic and incoherent vision, his incoherent foreign policy, who can't even stop these two allies from fighting against each other at this point. Iraqi Prime Minister Abadi had demanded that Kurdish leaders surrender control of Kirkuk. These were the oil fields and other disputed areas that fell under Kurdish control 3 years ago when ISIS was run out of the area. Abadi repeatedly said in recent days that his government had no plans to attack Kurdish forces defending the area. On Friday, Mr. Abadi tweeted that media reports of an imminent assault were, quote, fake news. Sound familiar? That's apparently the Trump doctrine. Anything you don't like reported, just call it fake news, and the suckers and rubes who follow you may actually believe it. All right, I got to get to Heather here. We'll take a quick break. Speaking of fake news and rubes and suckers, we'll talk with her about this Values Voters Summit over the weekend where Donald Trump spoke. And is something happening? Is something finally changing inside the Republican caucus, inside Congress? When it comes to the behavior of this president, we'll talk to her about that and much more after this. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.
No, as usual, it's not.
There's a man with a gun.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Is something happening here? We'll talk with Heather Digby Parton very momentarily about that. Because last week, I had briefly mentioned that the Boy Scouts had announced they were allowing girls to join. I quipped at the time something like, let their right-wing outrage begin. Well, sure enough, over the weekend at the so-called Values Voters Summit, which is a right-wing so-called conservative gathering in Washington, D.C., one of the nuts that was featured as one of the speakers there was a Fox News host. Now, setting aside, imagine if MSNBC, a host from there, had spoken at a far-left summit, if the far-left actually had any kind of summit or gathering at all. But anyway, here was Fox News host Todd Starnes, who told this to the crowd.
The sex and gender revolutionaries and the cultural jihadists are on the warpath. They are loud and they are proud. Just the other day, the Boy Scouts announced they will allow girls to join their once storied organization. Many of you have started hearing a phrase in the mainstream media, something called toxic masculinity. It's not just a war on boys, it's a war on men. And there are those in this country that want to feminize men. They want to criminalize masculinity.
Yes, not crazy at all, Todd Starnes from Fox News. So now the Boy Scouts are cultural jihadists. What's he talking about? I don't really know. Maybe my guest will in a second. Then there was a right-wing talk radio host and National Rifle Association provocateur Dana Loesch, who said stuff like this.
We are in a post-feminist era. Feminism is dead. It is dead as a doornail. It is dead.
And the crowd went wild. What are these people actually talking about? I don't know. But the crowd appeared to love it. And they loved even more when the president of the United States, the first time, as I understand it, a sitting president has appeared at this conference, a president who just today at the White House blatantly lied to the American public, to the media, to everyone else about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare no longer existing, just days before the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act. Or Obamacare was about to begin for the entire nation. At the so-called Values Voters Summit, they loved it when Donald Trump said stuff to them like this.
We are stopping
call the attacks on Judeo-Christian values. You go to department stores and they'll say Happy New Year, and they'll say other things, and it'll be red, they'll have it painted, but they don't say, well, guess what? We're saying Merry Christmas again.
Fantastic victory, Mr. Trump. So we are stopping cold the attacks on Judeo-Christian values, he told that crowd, who you could hear, they were delighted to hear from Trump. The comment, that one in particular, led David Frum, a longtime Republican opponent of Trump's, to tweet in response to stopping cold the attacks on Judeo-Christian values. Frum tweeted, except, of course, for thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not bear false witness, and thou shalt not covet. Well, that's true, though David Frum, the former George W. Bush administration speechwriter, said to have penned the phrase axis of evil to describe Iraq, Iran, and North Korea in the run-up to war with Iraq, seems to have left off thou shalt not kill for some reason. I don't know why he didn't include it in his tweet. Maybe he didn't feel comfortable mentioning that particular Judeo-Christian value in his Twittered indignation of Trump's remarks. But the shocking disclosures over the past year that Roger Ailes, the former head of Fox News, and Harvey Weinstein, now disgraced Hollywood movie mogul, that they basically led reigns of terror at the top of the political, media, and entertainment world for decades brings Trump's behavior once more into sharp relief. One would assume that America's conservative Christians would be totally appalled. Instead, as Heather Digby Parton notes at Salon, this past weekend, Trump became the first sitting president to attend the Family Research Council's annual gathering, the Values Voters Summit, where he received a hero's welcome, she writes. She goes on to say, perhaps that's not surprising. Despite Trump's long record of immoral behavior, white conservative evangelicals are among the most fervent and loyal of his supporters. Still, for some reason, a Reuters poll last month found that more than 60% of white evangelicals still back him. According to Trump, their shared values are the most important of all. Speaking at that summit, he said George Washington said that religion and morality are indispensable to America's happiness, really prosperity, and totally to its success. It's our faith and our values that inspires us to give with charity, to act with courage, and to sacrifice for what we know is right. That was Donald Trump this weekend. You just have to laugh, writes Digby. I'd love to, but it all doesn't seem quite as funny as maybe it used to be. Joining us now to talk about that and more is the one and only Heather Digby Parton, often known as Simply Digby. She's the creator of the long-running Hullabaloo blog, a regular contributor at Salon.com, winner of the Sidney Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. And, well, she's, of course, a longtime friend of the broadcast. Hey, Heather, welcome back to the broadcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brad.
All right. I want to talk about this incredibly bizarre take that the folks calling themselves conservative, much less Christian conservative, still seem to have on this president. But we haven't spoken for a while, and I like to check in with you at the very least at what seemed to be sort of key moments in his, well, first his campaign, now his presidency. You wrote at length last week at Salon about how many times throughout his presidency and his campaign that folks have suggested Republicans are finally turning on him, perhaps, and that speculation turned out to be false. But you felt with his recent behavior last week, his attacks on, I guess, Senator Corker, his own Secretary of State, his Iran and healthcare policy, that something may have changed or might be changing. And I don't necessarily disagree, Heather, but let me allow you to defend that statement. Something is happening here. Something actually is finally changing as you see it, maybe?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to know. And, you know, I'm not going to put my, you know, my mortgage on the line on that because we've
too late.
All
you already did. I saw it at Salon. Too late. Go ahead.
Well, okay. My reasoning for that was this. I mean, putting out there, yeah, and I've been on this show many times, and you and I have talked about this, about how, you know, the speculation that Trump's going to pivot, or that he's growing in the job, or that he's done, or that they're turning on him, or whatever, it's always been wrong. And I think I say at the beginning of that piece that you quote, the smart money is to bet that he's going to survive this, too, because he always has. So, giving myself that much of a disclaimer, I do go on to say that there does seem to be something happening that I find very curious in all of this. And it's not because, you know, he's done something in particular. What this is that there are now a series of reports coming from within the White House, from within Republican circles. Of course, they're all incredible cowards, which we know they are. These are the most cowardly people. In fact, back in the 2000s, during the Bush years, I used to call them the invertebrate caucus. And people always thought I was talking about the Democrats. I'm going, no, it's the Republicans. They're the ones who just, you know, they don't have any, you know, any sense of independence. They're always just going right along with the crowd. They never, ever buck the system. I mean, Democrats are almost as bad, but they're actually a little bit better when it comes to that sort of thing. In any case, you know, all of these ideas that there's going to be some big revolt or whatever are usually wildly overstated. But this is coming from, I mean, we've got reporters in the Washington Post, for instance, who are saying they've got 18 sources. Stories about Trump's behavior. Now, maybe they're all lying, but I maybe they are, but I doubt it. What is happening is, and I think I put it in the piece, this is like a cry for help that's coming from inside the White House, that the man is losing it. Now, Gabriel Sherman at Vanity Fair has been sort of tracking this. I don't know who his sources are, of course. But he, you know, he's a very provocative writer, and he wrote the book on Roger Ailes long before it actually was revealed that Ailes was running basically a brothel in Fox News, and that, you know, all these the women that worked there were subject to this, you know, horrifying sort of coercion from the guy on top. So, you know, I tend to think that he's a guy who obviously has good sources, and the stuff he's been writing in Vanity Fair is really stunning. I mean, this is, you know, Trump running around saying, I hate everyone in the White House, I can't stand it, watching TV all day long in the Oval Office, and basically they're trying to keep him from doing the sort of thing that he did today, which was hold a freewheeling press conference. And you know, stick his foot in his mouth. I don't know how many dozens of times that he did, but you know, with Corker coming forward the way he did last week, and has been kind of leading up to for a long time, for several months, saying that the guy, you know, he's unprepared. It's nothing but chaos. He's
Corker, you know, talking about Trump, saying
about
that
Trump,
he's right, and that the Secretary Tillerson and James Mattis are the only, and John Kelly, the chief of staff, are the only ones separating this country from chaos. Yeah,
right. And you know, and I'm very skeptical about the whole Mattis, McMaster, Tillerson, you know, triumvirate of alleged grown-ups. I mean, to me, I think there's a good case to be made that they're enablers, not that they're, you know, doing anything, you know, that's really useful. I mean, I keep wondering, you know, maybe they need to resign en masse if this is really happening and tell the world what's going on. I mean, maybe that's what needs to happen, because this is very, very dangerous. I mean, the stuff that's, it'd be one thing if this was just sort of domestic churning, you know, with, you know, the Mitch McConnell and Trump having battles and what have you. You know, that's interesting and that's fine, but there are real consequences to what's going on, some of which are domestic, like what you talked about with the Affordable Care Act, which is a nightmare, and also, you know, the reaction to the natural disasters, and then, of course, there's foreign policy and national security, which is absolutely terrifying. This guy can really do some damage. So
and it seems like it's just getting farther and far. You know, it was one thing to have these positions, to have these statements. The Affordable Care Act is a disaster. Iran, it's the worst deal ever made. It's one thing to say that when you're on the stump. It's even, you know, even early in a presidency. But then once you get confronted with the facts and everyone else is saying, yes, Iran is complying with the deal. No, the Affordable Care Act is not a disaster. It's added 30 million people and they can't even, you know, to the insurance rules, and the Republicans can't even repeal it because they realize how many people would be hurt by that. You get to that point and it seems like he's kind of backed into a corner now. He either has to admit that he was wrong on all of those things, or he needs to start acting out like he seems to be doing now.
Well, he is, and this is where it gets really interesting. Trump will never admit he was wrong about anything.
Right.
I mean, that, you know, he just will say black is white, up is down, whatever he needs to do.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these stories that have come out over the last couple of weeks, and another little bit of evidence that maybe something is shifting, at least in terms of the way they're handling him, if not, you know, any sort of real shift in the all, you know, in the mm-hmm. Republican approach. And, of course, this is all Republicans. Democrats are just, you know, they're sitting on the sidelines going, oh, okay, you know, let her rip. But they don't really have much choice. But the stories of Trump, their handling of him, I mean, first of all, there was one in the Washington Post today that just astonished me. They have to go around flattering the guy all the time, really flattering him. Just, you know, you're terrific, you're brilliant, everything, you know, you're just the smartest, greatest. It's just sickening, you know. It's repulsive to me as an American. This, you know, he's not a king. This isn't King Joffrey. I mean, this is ridiculous that they have to do this. But that's part of the shtick. They figured out that they have to flatter him constantly. But more importantly, what they have to do is kind of handle him by giving him, you know, treating him like a toddler, essentially saying, okay, here are your two choices, and trying to limit, mm-hmm. you know, what he knows and keep the information from him, then tell him things they hope he forgets about a week later. But what's ending up happening, the real results of that, the Iran deal is a good example. He wants to end that deal because that's what he promised to do when he was in the, you know, on the campaign trail, and he's just really loath to admit that he was wrong about that. So they've got him, you know, decertifying it and then sending him to Congress,
mm-hmm.
and basically punting to Congress on the thing.
Right.
Well, that's a terrible thing to do, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's okay, I guess it's better than him just basically saying, all right, that's it, and tearing the thing up. But it's not good.
No, it buys us time, it seems, at best. And you're right, this idea, and we, you know, we've been covering a lot of these stories as well, his, you know, reports that he was absolutely livid to hear once again that Iran was indeed honoring the anti-nuclear agreement, and the way that they treat him. You actually pointed out, I think this was a few weeks back, maybe a couple of months back, you highlighted this Twilight Zone episode,
yeah.
which was perfect, that people should remember with little Ronnie Howard, right?
No, actually, it was Billy Mumy.
Oh, that's right.
Billy Mumy was called It's a Good Life.
Right, that's right. And who they were all, everyone in this town, I'm sure folks remember this, were afraid.
Terrified
of this little boy because he had some sort of power that when he got mad at people, wanted to turn them into monsters or kill them, they would die. Here was, I think, do we have a little clip of that? Go ahead, Des.
Why, that's real good, whatever it is. Well, it's real fine that you've done that. That's real fine, Anthony. You're a good boy, Anthony.
And that's what they tell him throughout the entire thing, because God forbid he should get angry. That's kind of what we have going on in the White House at this point, Heather?
I think so. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. I mean, that's certainly something that, you know, came to my mind when I started
yep.
hearing these stories about how, you know, because this is the guy who, I mean, he does have control of the nuclear arsenal. And, you know, speaking of which, one of the big stories that came out as part of this whole kind of unfolding of this new chapter, whether it's the final chapter or it's just another one, is about, you know, him calling, you know, Rex Tillerson calling him an effing moron
right.
last summer.
Yep.
And the reason that he did that was there were two meetings that were held. And they were both, obviously, national security and foreign policy meetings. One of them was at the White House, where he told, and we all had heard about this earlier, there were a lot of people there, and he told the story about how he'd heard from some veterans mm-hmm. from Afghanistan who told him that none of the generals were telling him the right thing, that they didn't know anything, that NATO was letting everybody down, and was very upset to find out that we didn't, that the United States didn't have all the mineral rights. You know, how obsessed he is with stealing the resources to
right.
the victors belong the spoils, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And he said in that meeting that, you know, he told the story about the 21 Club, about how they, you know, he remembered his friend who ran the 21 Club, shut him down for a year and had experts come in.
Restaurant
really
in a restaurant in New York City.
Right, a restaurant, right,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
And that the lesson here, the parable was that they should have asked the wait staff rather than call in experts, and that they lost all kinds of money because they were closed for a year listening to experts who didn't really know what they were doing. Well, that's cute, except for the fact it wasn't true at all. It's a complete lie.
The 21 Club,
he made it up. The 21 Club did not close down for a year. It was closed for something like 4 weeks. And the whole thing was nonsense. But they came away from that meeting, the people, the principals who were in there, all the experts and the members of the Pentagon and the State Department and what have you, came out of there going, oh, my God, you know, this guy's really, I mean, infantile. His worldview is scary stupid. So they set up a meeting for the next day at the Pentagon where they realized that they had to outline for Trump what American power was, where they were deployed around the world, the history of American, you know, the American security umbrella mm-hmm. after World War II. I mean, you know, the guy really is an effing moron. And in the course of that, they tell him, they show him a slide that mm-hmm. they had prepared showing the nuclear arsenal, which at one point had had 32,000 nukes, which was sometime in 1969, the height of the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
and has since been reduced over the course of many years of detente and non-proliferation agreements, et cetera, to the point where it is now about 4,000. Of course, the nukes are much more modern, and it's a much different capability than it was at the time. Trump apparently looked at that and said, why don't we have that many anymore? I want that many. You know, I don't want, why do we have so few nukes? And everybody's kind of gasping, you know, oh my God. And apparently he said the same thing about every example of the military. I mm-hmm. want more, you know, like M-O-A-R, you know, more,
right.
you know, more.
Right.
This is the extent of his philosophy. Which is, you know, and he said it on the campaign trail. You and I both know that he didn't make a secret of this. We're going to have the strongest, greatest, biggest military the world has ever seen. And
no,
everybody went, oh, he's an isolationist, isn't that nice?
He literally tweeted, it was back in December of 2016, that we need to increase the nuclear arsenal. And so then he's furious and wants to put MSNBC, wants to take away NBC News' broadcast license.
Right.
Because they reported all of this.
Right. I mean, it's obvious that he thought that he was completely clueless.
Yeah.
And, of course, after that meeting, that was when apparently in the room, and I don't know how many people were there, but it was a small group of people,
mm-hmm.
and this was confirmed by many journalists now, but with more than one person, that that's when the Secretary of State called Trump an effing moron. Well, you know, he is. This is, if there's one thing that I've heard of, you know, sort of anonymous sources quoting people within the Trump administration, that's one I absolutely believe is true, because it is true.
Well, and Tillerson has been given multiple opportunities to say
yes.
It didn't happen. I think over the weekend he was asked like three times on Meet the Press or something, and he would not dispute that he actually did at least call him a moron, effing or otherwise. Heather, I want to get very quickly to this Values Voters
yep.
Summit, but let me just ask you one more question quickly on this point. Why would, if something is changing here, I presume you saw that conversation that was Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, I think,
mm-hmm.
under Bill Clinton. Did you see that conversation that he
I
reported
did.
With a U.S. senator, in which he said that the GOP will basically tolerate whatever they need to at this point in order to get tax reform done? So, A, why would the GOP, the members of Congress, suddenly change now? when reportedly all they want is tax reform, and B, why wouldn't they change now? You got Mike Pence. I mean, if you do get rid of Donald Trump, you still have Mike Pence, who agrees with everything this president has to say, basically, and is probably better at pulling off policy without the sort of firestorms that Donald Trump lights every day. So, A, why would they change now? And B, why don't they change now?
Well, I wish I knew. I mean, I suspect that it's because they've been spooked by this idea that their base is going to turn on them. So they're all afraid of losing their seats, which makes them really cowardly. I mean, the worst of all possible worlds, cowardly. Sure. Let's threaten nuclear war. Let's, have the entire world, look down on us. Let's have all soft power by the United States be completely destroyed. Mm-hmm. Because I might lose my seat, and that's just more, that's just too much. I mean, these people are really, really cowardly. And that's my personal opinion. I think that's what it is. They're spooked by their own base. And I'm not even sure it's true. Now, 2018 will tell the tale, right? We'll see what happens. But whether or not this, Steve Bannon and the rest of this crew have any real juice, we'll find out. But in the meantime, I think that the tax cuts are the one thing they think they can bring home and that their base is clamoring for. When in reality, really, it's their donors, right, that are clamoring for it. So maybe they're figuring, I'm just thinking this is on the fly here, maybe they're figuring that a bunch of them are going to lose their seats, and they just want to make sure they keep the donors happy because they, they got to go out and make some money after they get kicked out of office. I don't know, but it is a really, if you ever thought that these guys were patriots, and I love these people just talking about the flag and forcing everybody to stand at attention for freedom and liberty, all these people, they don't have the guts to actually stand up for the country when a maniac is running things, and they have the power to do something about it. So don't count on them.
That's very troubling. But speaking of what their base is clamoring for, let's do this. Sit tight, Heather Digby Parton. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about that Values Voters Summit and what the hell these so-called religious right voters must actually be thinking at this point about Donald Trump. Why is it they still love him, knowing what they surely do, don't they? Quick break, and we'll come back with Digby right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast.
Because you know I'm all about the bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass.
Yes, he certainly is. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com speaking with Heather Digby Parton, the one and only from Digby's Hullabaloo blog and salon.com. Heather, you mentioned before the break talking about what their base, what the GOP base, Donald Trump's base, is clamoring for. So speaking of the base, who still are rallying around this president for some reason, specifically the Family Research Council's Values Voters Summit over the weekend in D.C., Think Progress interviewed some of the attendees at that summit who said things like, "I love President Trump. He's really evolved. He has a biblical worldview now as opposed to just a billionaire's worldview." These are direct quotes that Think Progress reported from various sources. Where and how is it possible that those folks can have that impression given so much of what we know about this president, even, going back to, what was it, the summer of 2016, the Hollywood Access tape, the things he said, I won't bother repeating those here, all of the, the women who have stepped forward. How is it that people who, I guess, call themselves Christian do not see all of these things that people with eyeballs and ears actually seem to be able to see and hear? How can that still be the case this long into this?
I know, and I find it astonishing, too. Now, a lot of people, and I've been kind of going back and forth with, some other people on this as well, who are pointing out, and I think it's fair to at least point this out, that these people, there is a right-wing media bubble that is, you know, very, very tight.
Mm-hmm.
It is, and, you know, I think it's exacerbated by social media, Facebook in particular, and a lot of these people are just living in a world where they may not actually, I mean, if you look at Fox News, I have never seen, we know Fox is bad, mm-hmm. and that it's been a propaganda arm for the Republican Party from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
This is something new. I mean, they are in a completely different universe. They're not reporting a lot of this. So if people are depending on that and depending on talk radio and their Facebook friends and all of this, you know, they may not be getting the full picture. I'm ready to grant that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I also think these people are adults. I think many of those people at the Values Voter Summit, those are political activists. I find it a little hard to believe that they're not getting any of this, that they're not seeing anything, that they're just so completely oblivious that they don't even know, that they don't even see the crudeness of Donald Trump. I mean, just the coarseness of him, the kind of piggishness of him, and I'm not just talking in terms of the sexual harassment, although that certainly was a huge story, and I know they all saw that. But let's just assume that, you know, they've blanked it out for their own reasons. Just, you know, observing him at all. He's a disgusting human being. He's repulsive. And the idea that these Christians are seeing him as some godly creature who is, you know, somehow has a biblical worldview, well, I guess if you want to get really Old Testament about it, I guess in some ways he does. But, you know, it's not really, I mean, this is not what I had ever thought growing up was the standard Christian worldview. Now, it has to be said that a lot of these people, I mean, this is the Christian right, and they're white. Now, there are plenty of evangelicals and even conservative Christians in this country who are people of color, Hispanic and African American, and they're not seeing this in him. They're not living in that world. So, you know, there some of this has to do with their particular demographic orientation, let me just put it that way. And I think that the Values Voter Summit really showed that. I mean, they welcomed Donald Trump, they welcomed Steve Bannon, they welcomed Sebastian Gorka, and those three men, there's not a Christian bone in their bodies, and I don't know if any of them have ever even been to church.
And they had Steve Bannon and Sebastian Gorka both fired by Trump once the pressure, I guess, got so bad that he had to. But they have made clear that they're going to war against Republicans themselves. I don't have time. I wanted to play Gorka's statement. I'm running really short here. But, Heather, it occurs to me that, you know, even with these guys who are declaring war on Republicans themselves, you know, the Republican Party back in George W. Bush's day and David Frum's day, since I mentioned him earlier, but even going back to Ronald Reagan, they essentially decided that they needed to have the far right religious nuts as part of the Republican coalition pretty much in order to survive. And similarly, I'm wondering now, have they just realized, well, our numbers are getting smaller and smaller, and so for the far right religious nuts, they have realized that they need white nationalism as a faction to survive, or have they really always been the same faction, Heather?
Well, I think they may have always been the same faction, but I think that there's more of a conscious recognition of this as being part of their philosophy. And, you know, and the ways that they're coming at this is through their Islamophobia. You know, the Sharia law stuff, the fact that Muslims are, you know, the stuff they were saying at this Values Voter Summit, it was hideous. I mean, they're bringing diseases, you know, the Muslims are bringing diseases, they're infecting good Americans, they're rapists, you know, all the same stuff that Trump was saying about Mexicans, you know, they're saying about Muslims at the Values Voter Summit. So I think they're coming at it that way. We're protecting our religion.
And apparently feminists.
Oh,
and
my God.
Boy Scouts. And, I mean, you know, take your pick.
Liberals, Democrats, the left. I mean, there was one attack. In fact, Sebastian Gorka, his quote, which you were probably going to say, was they don't realize how much more damage we can do to the left from the outside, which was kind of like creepy, considering he's an actual real life metal wearing Nazi. I was kind of like, oh my God, you know, whoa.
It's getting scary. Heather, I got to get out. It's each and every day is scarier than the next. So
no,
we'll be calling you on the next very scary day. You know, I wanted to, I don't have time. Never mind. But suffice to say, I think you're absolutely right. The Democrats and the nation as a whole are still wildly underestimating the damage of Fox News and political right-wing radio and the damage that does and that puts into people's brain and what Democrats are facing with a brainwashed group of supporters like those at the Values Voter Summit. Heather Digby Parton, check out her work on Alt-Right Meets Christian Right, A Marriage Made in Hell at Salon.com today, and so much more over there. You should also visit her regularly at digbysblog.blogspot.com and follow her on the Twitters at Digby56. Thank you so much, Heather. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay, before we go, by way of a public service announcement, I guess, very quickly, here's what Donald Trump said before a cabinet meeting today in the White House. Go ahead.
Obamacare is finished. It's dead. It's gone. It's no longer, you shouldn't even mention, it's gone. There is no such thing as Obamacare anymore. It is and I said this years ago, it's a concept that couldn't have worked. In its best days, it couldn't have worked.
Okay, I got to get out, but I got to tell you, that is wrong. That is wildly irresponsible. The president of the United States just said that Obamacare no longer exists.
That's a lie.
A lie. It is, as he likes to call it, fake news. This is just days before. Just days before open enrollment is going to begin on November 1. For people to sign up via healthcare.gov all across all 50 states. To sign up for healthcare from November 1 through December 15 because they cut that period in half. But it is not gone. You need to know that. You need to make sure you got healthcare by stopping by healthcare.gov. If you need it, you can purchase it there. I just have to say that because it's a blatant lie. Fake news right from the White House and the President of the United States. All right. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's Bradcast, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. Thanks, as ever, to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. To help us continue to do what we try to do every day on your public airwaves. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.